The next case is 05-896, Keith Theobald versus the University of Cincinnati. Mr. Holland.
Mr. Chief Justice, if it pleases the court, my name is Douglas C. Holland. I represent Keith Theobald, Jackie Theobald, Jacob and Keisha Theobald. This is a, and I'd like to reserve 6 minutes for my rebuttal. The appellate court opinion in this case has greatly expanded public liability within the state of Ohio for professional malpractice and actually for all state employees, and is in direct conflict with other appellate court opinions. The so-called state employees can now have a private and lucrative medical practice or any type of practice and still be considered state employees.
Let me interrupt you, and I'm just curious. If we affirm here, it means that your claim would be in the court of claims. Is that
yes, right? Your Honor.
And you have some resistance to having this claim tried in the court of claims.
Absolutely, because the facts of this case are statute of limitations of medical malpractice is 1 year. We timely filed against the doctors. We have a doctor with Mayfield Clinic neurosurgeon. Mr. Theobald signed a informed consent specifically asking for this doctor because of his expertise, world-renowned, that, and then after we filed suit substantial period afterwards, and defense counsel said, oh, well, this is not really an issue, don't worry about it, until we're in trial, almost getting ready for trial, and then they say, well, we want to stay this until there's a determination, requiring us to sue University of Cincinnati, which we believe had nothing to do with this case whatsoever. So that's delayed us. We're 4 years out from the Court of Claims decision, I think near 5 years out from when we filed. So we'll be at least 6 years before we get back. Then there's the issue of, are we timely in the statute of limitations or not? And then even if we're in the court of claims, our damages are completely reduced. Mrs. Theobald, who they blinded her husband, lost most of the use of his arms, after he had a car wreck to paralyze him from the waist down, has no rights or remedy at all. And Mr. Theobald, who is going to have a lifetime requirement of medical care, and that for his life is limited to very small amount in the court of claims. And again, the point of this is that Mr. Theobald was not a patient of the state of Ohio. He was in a private hospital, university hospital. He had no choice of going there. That's the only one with air care and a trauma area that would cover him. It was not a state clinic. He was not a patient of UC. The doctors are highly paid by Keith Theobald for his operation and his care in the hospital. The appellate court says there's no requirement of actually even state employment because our complaint has nothing to do with teaching of students. And even the students, and then they were residents mainly, were paid employees of the hospital doing their private employment. And the best that the defense can say is they were observing the actions of malpractice.
There was a student in the room, was there not?
Well, there was a resident that came in with a trauma surgeon, Dr. Lucchetti, and left with him. There was a resident with a neurosurgeon because surgeons need assistance. A hospital provides these assistants, residents. Mr. Theobald pays for those services. Then there was an anesthetist who was doing his job. There was a CRNA who was doing her job. And then there was an RN in the room who was a student CRNA who was being paid by the hospital doing her normal employment. And the appellate court says, well, that's enough to get everybody off because the RN was just keeping records, wasn't teaching. There is no teaching actually going on. They don't even say that. They say just observations of the malpractice.
Is this not a teaching hospital?
No,
what we would call
it's a
teaching
private hospital. It used to be a teaching hospital. They've gone private.
It's been converted to a private hospital.
And what's interesting is the doctors who actually did the performing, the captains of the ship, now get immunity, while the residents have no immunity, the student has no immunity, and the hospital has no immunity. And basically, what the appellee brief is, they want the court to rule that just, we don't even need a student, we just need to be in this practice corporation. A practice corporation is a system where the University of Cincinnati and other universities go out to get professors and say, okay, we're going to set you up as a partner in a medical practice, you're going to practice privately, you're going to get well paid, you're going to come in as part, teach one class a semester, and that, and then not only that, but what the doctors earn pays the corporations to operate like a regular medical corporation, and then they pay the university more than the university pays a small amount of salary back to the doctors, and that is in the record. Mr. Breidenbaugh says that, you know, we gave $1.3 million to the university, and then they give a couple thousand back to the doctors. And especially we have Mayfield Clinic, world-renowned for-profit corporation, and they're saying that Dr. Mayfield and the appellate court, that Dr. Mayfield is now immune. If this court rules, and again, you're going to set it for all state employees, not just the doctors at UC.
Counsel, what would your test, what would you propose the test to be to determine whether personnel, such as these doctors, were, would enjoy the immunity?
Okay.
What would they have to have done, in your opinion?
Oh, what? Okay. We would have to sue, basically, for the state employment, that they did a lousy job of teaching. They were maybe supposed to be supervising the residents, and then their supervision of the residents, they went off somewhere else and didn't supervise, and we sue them on the non-supervision, which then would be, like in the Ohio State, in the clinic run by Ohio State, that would be their function, and therefore they violated their state function.
So are you saying that the doctors should have primarily been employees of the, in their teaching capacity, and because they had their private corporate capacity, that takes them out of the potential for immunity?
It should absolutely take them out.
Well, is it a 50-50? They should have been 50% teaching and 50% in private activity, or 10% in private activity and 90% teaching? What, or are you saying if there's any private activity that it precludes immunity?
Exactly. And I think if you look at the statute, the way the court interpreted the statute, manifestly outside the scope of employment, they're saying the legislature meant that to be inclusive. First, we consider, is there any scintilla of state employment? If there is, then there's immunity. I don't believe that this court will rule that way, and I don't believe that because the legislature didn't do it. They looked at manifestly outside as the state employee during his employment. Let's take there's a rainy day out and you're state highway inspector and you're on a job site and you rained out. So you go with a couple of the contractors and you get 10 drinks and you have a fight and you injure one of the contractors. He's a state employee being paid, but going to a bar, having 10 drinks, you're manifestly outside your state employment. Therefore, there's no immunity for this person. That, to me, is the concept of law, not can we find some inkling of state employment, because if this court upholds that ruling, then, and then the appellate brief says, well, the department heads will then have total decision of who gets immunity and not. Legislature won't have it, the courts won't have it, department of heads or who will give this out, and they said there would be restraint. But if you're a department head and Procter & Gamble comes to you and is going to supply something to your department head or your university and says, well, if you give us immunity, for these employees, we'll reduce it by $2 or $3 million. We're helping out the university. We're teaching students because you're going to get it for less. But then the state becomes liable for all those. Every employee that you can tie in any type, and if you had somebody judgment proof, indigent or anything, if you could tie them to an employee or the state in any way, volunteer. We have the nurse, CRNA Paris, stated under oath, I am not an employee of UC. I have no state employment. And then the court says, well, But when she signs in with her practice corporation, they have her, the attorneys have her sign a paper so she's going to volunteer and help out wherever she can. Well, sure. But then the state, and then the Court of Appeals says that's enough to get immunity.
Counsel, you indicated that if we affirm the Court of Appeals, you even have an issue as to whether or not there's the action in the Court of Claims is timely filed.
That's something I'm sure we're going to be litigating. I've been litigating.
The university has not stipulated that in stepping into the shoes of the, I mean, they're arguing that they should step into the shoes of all of these people, but they're not conceding that the case is timely filed.
No, what happened is the court stayed our common pleas, and
I understand all that, but they're not conceding that.
No, they're not.
Have they given you any discovery?
I don't know what you mean by discovery.
Depose any doctors or...
We've done that in the common plea. We were ready for trial and common pleas. And then at that time, they said, well, we need to stay because you have to sue the University of Cincinnati. And so
you had gone through discovery in the Court of Common Pleas. You were ready for trial.
Yes.
And then this...
was stayed until we get this resolved.
And who raised it at that point?
All the defendant doctors.
Okay. Your client's wife signed a waiver, or informed consent.
Yes, sir.
Not a waiver. Yeah. Did that tell them that there are students maybe operating on?
Absolutely
on her
not,
husband?
Your Honor.
Did it tell her that all of our doctors are employees of the university and? If something goes wrong, if there's a medical accident, that your constitutional right to a jury trial is gone, and that you would have to proceed in the Court of Claims against the state.
No, Your Honor, and that is in the record, and it actually says we want you to consent for us to be your doctor, patient client, patient doctor relationship. And that's all it said is, we want to be your doctor. And that was Dr. Taha, Dr. Lucetti, and also Dr. Sharma, the anesthesiologist. They were all signed saying, we want to be your doctor.
There's
no notice at all.
There's something Judge Klatt says in the Court of Appeals opinion, something about some evidence that he can't find. Can you comment on that? You remember statement in the...
I don't recall that.
Okay. The Mayfield Clinic... was a private for-profit corporation, was it?
Yes,
not?
Sir.
And the principal surgeon here was employed by the Mayfield Clinic, was he not?
That, and he testified under oath that he received no money from University of Cincinnati. Mayfield Clinic received $10,000-$12,000 a year. And in the appellate brief, they say, well, that's enough to make you the same as this private practice corporation,
and
which
they
are.
He's the one doing the surgery on the spine, is he?
Yes.
Not?
Yes, sir.
All right. And I believe, I think this was in the state's brief, that they indicated that he received permission from the university to be employed by the Mayfield Clinic.
No. He was, Your Honor, my understanding is he was employed by the Mayfield Clinic, and the university paid Mayfield Clinic some money to have Dr. Taha work with their neurosurgeon residents. And the relationship was just the opposite, that Dr. Taha worked for Mayfield, and Mayfield's tied with the University of Cincinnati, of course, and to teach on a kind of a side basis, not as main basis.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holland. Mr. Crawford.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this case rests on a straightforward interpretation of two statutes that deliver on the General Assembly's promise of civil immunity to all state employees who are not acting manifestly outside their scope of employment. This case is not about the variety of other issues that the appellants raise, because those arguments don't address the familiar inquiry at the heart of this case. At the time of the alleged malpractice, were these university faculty members doing exactly what the university hired them to do. If so, the General Assembly says they're immune, the state is consented to be sued in the Court of Claims, and the plaintiffs can file there, and in fact, they often do. The Court of Claims Act allows, or certainly doesn't prohibit, individuals from dual filing in the Court of Claims and the Court of Common Pleas, and in fact, the Court of Claims Act provides that the statute of limitations in the Court of Claims will not run while you also have an action pending in the Court of Claims. So there's every incentive to file in the appropriate form to begin with. And indeed here, at least two of the defendants, Drs. Lucchetti and Dr. Taha, I believe, raised the immunity defense in their answer. And of course, by the time they filed the answer, the Court of Claims statute of limitations had already run because there was no due filing in this case.
So is it your position then that if you prevail, there's no recovery at all anywhere? That's a yes or no.
Well, it returns the case to the Court of Claims, Your Honor.
Is it your position that there's no opportunity to recover for this?
If these doctors are immune, we certainly will, assert the statute of limitations. I mean, there'll be other arguments in the Court of Claims that.
So your position is no recovery?
Our position is that the statute of limitations will bar this action in the Court of Claims.
Counsel, I would like you to comment on the fact that this is not a teaching hospital involved here, but a private hospital. That statement was made in answer to the Chief Justice's question.
Well, the hospital, Your Honor, is a private corporation. The property is leased by the university, but it's used by their faculty members, the people that they've appointed to their faculty to teach the residents at the University of Cincinnati. And I think the concern about whether or not these doctors may have some other employment that you could characterize as not being with the university, I think is answered pretty well by the Cinquilli case. In that case, this court considered whether a resident who was teaching at a private hospital could be a state employee too. And the plaintiff in that case argued that, well, this doctor is not entitled to an immunity determination. He's not a state employee because he's a lone servant working at this private hospital. This court said no. They said a state employee is a state employee. And then however you might characterize their employment with another institution doesn't diminish the fact that they're working for the state.
Well, counsel, would you say any time these doctors operated, they were state employees?
As long as they were doing what the university asked them to do, which is teach residents, provide direct patient care in the practice plan, which is, I think it's important to remember, this is a condition of their employment. This is what the university appointed them to do. And in fact, on at least one occasion, the University of Cincinnati has terminated a doctor.
So you would limit their ability to claim immunity to only situations where there were residents or some other students that were affiliated with the university, observing, participating, experiencing a teaching experience.
Well, Justice O'Connor, the agency principle that the General Assembly rests its immunity provision on is scope of employment. And scope of employment in the first instance depends on how the employer defines the duties. Certainly teaching residents, and there's a resident involved or a student involved at every stage of this medical procedure, certainly teaching of students falls within the core of their scope of employment. But if you look at the appointment letters that we've submitted in our supplement, the universities required them to do much more. They required them to provide direct patient care because they have to have a faculty that has honed skills, that they keep sharp through everyday practice of medicine, and they have to maintain a patient base. You just can't teach students in a classroom and then turn them loose as doctors. They have to participate in the day-in, day-out care of patients on a daily basis. And the university has to maintain that, and they maintain it with their faculty members, and I think that's what they've done here. So the principles, how has the university defined the scope of employment?
Then let me try to put that in real-life terms. If you have a physician that is operating at the hospital and has a resident assisting him, in your opinion, there's immunity, correct?
Well, I think without question. That certainly falls within the teaching obligation. Here you have, for example.
Let's take the next scenario. You have the same physician operating on a patient at the same hospital, but this time there's no resident with him. He's in the practice plan. It's a patient. He's taking care of it in the practice plan. But for some reason, spring vacation or whatever it is, there's no resident in that hospital teaching with him, and he's operating alone. In your opinion, is that still covered by the scope of employment?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a condition of that physician's employment that if he is going to be a faculty member, he has to see patients.
So in your opinion, then, if there is a physician in a practice plan that is being taken care of by the practice plan, there is always immunity because that practice plan is part of the teaching process.
As long as it falls within the scope of employment, not no malice involved, it's a condition of their employment. That's the way the University of Cincinnati has set the terms of employment for appointment on the faculty.
So the whole prior case law and financial incentives in the private practice versus the, that goes out the window under your analysis, does it not?
Well, I think it does, Justice Stratton. The 10th District's history of cases seems to be a search for what the 10th District believes university physicians should be doing. And it's geared towards discovering and answering a lot of questions that don't relate to how the University of Cincinnati's conditioned the employment of the doctors. We think a return to the principle of the scope of employment inquiry is critical to the case.
Counsel, though, let's take it to the ultimate conclusion here. You're saying that that what the university says is the scope of employment will control. So let's just argue that the university said, and any doctor employed by us is to be an excellent doctor. Within your viewpoint, then, anything that physician would do would be covered by the scope of employment as defined by the university, and there would be no action that the doctor took as a doctor that would ever not be immune.
I guess I'm not quite understanding your question.
I mean, you seem to be saying that the only thing that controls is how the contract is written and how the scope of employment is defined. And if that's so, if we accept that position, any university or any state institution that employs doctors could define the scope so broadly that a doctor would never be outside of the scope of employment. That doctor could never be sued because the doctor would always be immune.
Well, certainly the university and the employer's decision on how to define the scope of employment is the key consideration. I guess it's not to say it's without limits, but it's important to remember in these cases that, I mean, the interests of the university. They have defined, have said that what they need is physicians that have, you know, that practice routinely, and that see patients, and that do a variety of other things. I mean, for example, the University of Cincinnati supports indigent care at the University Hospital that's not necessarily involved with students. Those are things that have to be done. And again, it's not to say that there aren't limits, but the key question, what we're asking for, is application of common law principles, which seem
Counsel,
to be.
What limits? You said it's not to say they're not without limits, and I don't hear you carving out any exceptions to the application of immunity here?
Well, again, if you look at the restatement, for example, I mean, it lists a number of factors for deciding whether or not someone's in the scope of employment, and it considers factors that perhaps don't relate.
All right, let's back up. You say that one of the criteria is that the doctors maintain a patient load that will allow them to hone their skills and be the excellent doctors and therefore teachers that the university expects. So if the doctor is in his private practice, sees a patient in his own office, which is part of his caseload of patients, and commits malpractice in his office, is he immune?
He is. That's what the university's told him he has to do. And I think it's important, of course, to look at it.
Counsel. You know, you do concede in your brief that this is a departure from the prior jurisprudence of the 10th District, and the 10th District is important because we have said that the Court of Claims gets to make these calls.
Well, it begins in the Court of Claims, Your Honor. I mean, it eventually is appealed to this court.
But they initially get to make, the Court of Claims initially gets to make the calls, are you in the scope or are you not?
As they will in this case.
All right. And you do concede that Judge Klatt's opinion is a departure from the earlier jurisprudence of the 10th District.
Well, Your Honor, I think
he
perhaps not. I mean,
you say that in your brief. You say this is new.
Well, Your Honor, it's a new test. I mean, it doesn't fully respect the principles that we think the General Assembly was looking for in defining the scope of employment inquiry. I mean, I don't know that he necessarily abandon all of the principles before the education test.
Okay.
But he certainly
Would it be fair to say that the University of Cincinnati has historically going down one road. They want to be the umbrella to be stand in the shoes of everybody that goes near anybody in University Hospital, even though it's now not a part of the university. And that Ohio State, which is another big teaching hospital, has taken the exact opposite approach to this and argued forcefully in the Court of Claims the other way. Would that be a fair statement of the history?
It is in some cases. And
I
think
institutional positions.
But the institutional positions it may be, but that's because
okay, and the attorney, how does the attorney general decide which position to take? You've got Toledo with a medical teaching facility. You have one in Cleveland. You have others around the state. How do you decide that the University of Cincinnati is going to set the policy on this?
Well, Your Honor, each university, of course, can establish their own practice plan system the way they want. They can employ doctors on their own terms however they want. And I think there's nothing inconsistent about having two different employers define how they're going to employ their doctors
in two different ways.
It represents
a horrible peril for lawyers who attempt to represent people such as the plaintiff here who believes he was medically injured or injured as a result, damaged as a result of medical negligence, to keep track of what the inner workings and the practice plans and the secret documents are. It would seem, at least in fairness, you know, we require lawyers to tell every client they do or they do not have insurance. Wouldn't it seem that if you're going to take the approach that nobody that touches you, unless they come in, you know, drunk or fit into the exclusions under the statute, nobody that touches you in this hospital is going to have any personal immunity for any mistake they make. Only the hospital is. If that's going to be the rule, shouldn't that be in the consent forms that this plaintiff's wife had to sign?
Your Honor, the Court of Claims Act and the immunity provisions make no provisions for putting that in the consent form. This is very much the same system.
I'm asking you as a lawyer and as a matter of fairness and a matter of notice to people, don't you think that ought to be required?
As a matter of fairness, Your Honor, I don't think so. I mean, they were, of course, seen in the university hospital. They had information in the answers from some of the doctors that they sought to assert immunity. And I think this is very much the same principle that private employers have been dealing with for quite some time. They're responsible for their employees' acts that are within the scope of employment. And it certainly seems
well,
that the General Assembly wanted to
make... Well, in the medical setting, every hospital that isn't connected with the university argues forcefully that all the doctors here are private independent contractors.
Again, Your Honor, the principle is how does the employer condition their employment? And to say that the University of Cincinnati does one thing and the University of Cincinnati of Ohio, or the Ohio State University, I'm sorry, does something else, is not to suggest that the inquiry should be something other than scope of employment that's decided on a case-by-case basis.
Well, counsel, under your theory that if you're a teacher for the university and you've signed an employment agreement, no matter what the limited amount of exposure you have in your teaching role as a physician, everything you do in your private caseload is protected by that immunity.
Your Honor, I mean, I wouldn't call it the private caseload. This is what the university requires them to do through a practice plan whose president
sole shareholder. All right, I understand that. Anything in your practice that you do is a condition of employment, then as a physician, you don't need medical malpractice insurance.
Well, under our theory, perhaps not. But, of course, I mean, the past
Do these individuals have malpractice insurance?
They do. They are covered either through the university trust or, on some instances, the practice plans have their own. But, I mean, up to this point, of course, the history of the 10th District's decision, I mean, it's been quite unpredictable who will be immune and who will not. And it may be that, under our test, there may be different insurance concerns.
Counsel, the right of jury trial, is that a fundamental right?
Your Honor, it's a fundamental right, I think, for actions at common law. And suing the state, I don't believe, is one of them. And in any event, I mean, this court, I think, have said, for example, in the sovereign immunity provisions, that when it comes to suing the state, You know, these provisions are not self-executing.
But he didn't sue the state.
Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, the General Assembly, of course, has made the provision that you have to sue the state, you know, if you're going to sue a state employee. And at common law, I don't think that they would have a right necessarily to sue one of the employers for the acts here.
Is there any prohibition in the Court of Claims law against a jury trial? I think they've held a couple of jury trials, actually.
Perhaps, but I believe those are instances when the state has brought in another defendant that's made perhaps necessary for the case.
So that defendant gets the jury trial?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That defendant gets the jury trial. If it's a non-government, non-state defendant.
I think that would be true. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Mr. Holland, you've saved almost a minute and a half of your time.
Yes, I've tried to save more, but, Your Honor, this case, very, very good question, and I think the appellate really brought out they want absolute blanket immunity. That is a legislature decision. The Tenth Circuit made legislative decision in this case. The informed consent by a volunteer doctor who's volunteering his time to take care of indigent people in that has to go through a rigorous informed consent and then not even get immunity for the operations that would have been in this place. The bright line test that we advocate in our brief is basically the billing of the doctor of his private paying patient is manifestly outside the scope of public employment. That is what the bright line test should be. And then for a doctor to claim immunity, he needs, if he's able to get an informed consent, it must be a truly informed consent with all the issues there. On behalf of the Theobalds, I thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Holland. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.